Hello and welcome back to the London Architect podcast. My name is Lily Patience and I'm your host. In the London Architect, we discuss all things construction, planning and design, and we get the opportunity to chat with some really inspiring professionals who are able to offer us some tips and advice and just general industry knowledge. So today's guest is someone who I'm really excited to chat with, Liam Bedwell from Mybe Architects. How are you today, Liam?
I'm very good. Thank you for inviting us in.
You're very welcome. And could you just tell me, where have you travelled from today?
I've travelled from Greenwich, where our office is based, so North Greenwich today. So not too far.
Okay.
Not too far to go.
Do you come into central London often?
Only if we're looking at new projects.
Yeah.
We'll go further into the city, but we're generally southeast based, so we'll predominantly be in the office and around that area.
So you do a bit of work in London and in Essex, right? Is that because you live in Essex?
A lot of it's interesting. A lot of my connections go back to my father, actually. He's a contractor.
Yeah.
Small builder. And when we set up the practice, a lot of those initial projects came through his friends.
Yeah.
And, project managers that he knew that required architectural services. So that's kind of escalated, and we spend a lot of our time sort of 50-50 really in terms of projects based in London to projects based in Essex.
Yeah, that's a really nice way to get a business started, like through family connections.
Yeah, it kind of sort of spiraled. You sort of start one, it leads to another, and it soon becomes a business and not a hobby.
It's a good way to kind of lay the foundations for fruitful business.
I think so. I think it's also, it's nice the other way as well. We see it. It's like there's trust that we know these people, and we've either grown up with them or we've done building work with them previously. So they know us, they know our skill sets, and they kind of trust us as architects. So we're pushing more for London projects because that's where we're based, that's where we're set up. But we do enjoy the Essex projects because there's a lot of time that the land is less scarce and we've got a little bit more creativity.
Yeah, it must be a completely different landscape working in those two locations. Quite refreshing for you.
It is. We kind of, it's a diverse set of projects that it allows us to sort of tap into. The Essex based ones are very much new builds and rural housing projects, whereas London's very much more pushed towards the retrofit and commercial fit outs.
Yeah,
both of them are equally enjoyable, but they both come with different constraints and issues.
Yeah, definitely. And we can discuss that a bit later on. I've got some questions about one of your projects in Essex. But for now, I just wanted to start off with a fairly easy question. Could you tell me about your career journey so far?
Yes. So it depends on how far you want us to go back.
All the way. Yeah.
So again, I sort of mentioned it already. My dad is a builder.
Yes.
So as we were growing up, I would spend a lot of time building and, you know, labourer. And we was always interested. I keep saying we, it's definitely me. I was always interested in, you saw his passion of what he got from delivering projects, domestic, residential, extensions, new builds. And there was something wonderful about really being inspired by how proud someone is to transform space. And when I was younger, there was a lot of things that I wasn't good at in academia and school, but drawing, and if I found that I had the passion about something, I would apply my attention to it. And I think that was the main thing for me is architecture was something that I could invest time in and I wouldn't be distracted.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what got me into it. And I initially went to college to study 3D design. I think it covered model making, product design, interior design and architecture. I lasted 2 weeks in that course.
No.
We were building paper bridges, at which point I was 16 at the time. And I was like, I don't really want to be here building paper bridges.
I mean, what was your knowledge of engineering and bridges at that point?
Nothing.
Okay.
But I don't think at the time I was ready for further education. I wanted to go out.
It was quite young.
It was very young.
Yeah.
And I think we're all expected to know what we want at a certain time.
Definitely. I have experienced that. I think you are, you know, these questions are thrown at you from such an early age, and it kind of increases your anxiety about it because you're like, why don't I know what I want to do yet? When actually that comes a lot later on in life. But yeah, sorry, continue.
Exactly. And I decided to quit. So I quit the college course after 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Went into banking for 2 years.
Banking?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Surprise, surprise. So I worked at RBS and Lloyds TSB for 2 years. And I think that's what I needed at the time. I needed to mature.
Yeah.
I needed to depressurize what I wanted to do in my career.
Yeah.
I needed to earn some money.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed to mature in age. And after 2 years, I said, well, I want to go back. So I went back to the same course, to the same tutor. And I said, I'm really sorry that I didn't really give it a chance. But I also kind of, I don't feel bad about that because I wasn't ready. And my whole career has progressed because of that really important delay. I wasn't at that point ready to continue education. And I wanted to find that passion, and I did. And I went back, studied a course, and I was more serious about it, so I did better, naturally. Mm. And then after that, I went off to Brighton University to do my my part one degree. So I spent 3 years there. That was the first time I had left the town that I grew up in. And
what
I think, again,
like?
I think it was wonderful. It was scary at the same time, because when I went down to Brighton, it was terrible because I never really checked out the university before I went. And when I did go there, it was a sort of a whole new world. And again, I think your degree is a lot about what they teach you in school, but a lot about kind of being thrown in on your own. First time you have to really consider money and budgeting. Other than that, you're kind of in a bit of a bubble. And getting to know people that weren't necessarily part of your friendship group or these circles that you sort of grew up with.
I think it gives you a confidence in yourself. And then you realize that these options that you are presented with, they are exciting rather than something that you are frantically trying to make a decision over. Like you were saying, it's great to work with a parent or be inspired by a parent. But at that point, I think sometimes it feels like this has been bestowed upon you rather than something that you've actually chosen. So it's really nice that you kind of went away from that and then came back to it again and was like, actually, this is what I want to do.
Yeah, I think if you break it down like that, I definitely needed it to be my decision.
Yes,
it to be a decision that I could make and then back myself. And I think we all need that in life. And for me, the 2 years out was probably, it's weird because that's the most important 2 years of my career is actually a break from the career before it started.
Yeah, I think, I mean, a good piece of advice is just go with what feels right, you know, and even if it's completely off topic.
Absolutely. And it's not rushing your career. It can happen at any point. And a lot of the times you're, you know, a slight delay, you shouldn't call it a delay really, but a slight break allows you to come at it with a different perspective.
Well, yeah, it's character building as well. I mean, what was it like for you working in a bank? I mean, there must be some kind of crossover with architecture a little bit, the business side of it, but, you know, not really.
I think the banks, I was to do with sales. So you learn a lot of how to talk to people. And you learn a lot of the realities of working.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew what, you know, something simple, like you knew what a shift was and you knew how to do a long day. And they were really important, but also the value of money, of what it was worth. And what you could then do with it. I mean, at that age, what you did with it is go out, but you wouldn't do that.
But you had to learn that at some point. It's very important.
So it was really important time, I think, for me, especially when I went to universities. A lot of the students there were 18 and I was two years above. That didn't give me any advantage whatsoever, but it just meant that you had sort of been out and you had done something, and you knew that I knew myself personally that why I was there and what I wanted to achieve.
Yeah.
So I think that was really worthwhile.
Yeah. And so tell me, you then went to do your part one in Brighton.
Yeah.
What is Brighton like as a university? I know, like, well, I know it's a very vibrant place. What was your experience of that?
Brighton's incredible. Go back there most years.
Really?
And I think, again, it's just such an opposite to where I had sort of grown up.
Yeah.
I think you stick to your own bubbles a lot of the time when you grow up in schools mm-hmm. and you have your own friendship groups. You're very much all the same person.
Yeah.
And I think it was just incredibly diverse. I think perspective was one of the best things about Brighton.
Yeah.
And it's a university city, so you're around a lot of young people. And it's, yeah, incredible memories, incredible friends yeah. From there. And it was a good architecture course, which was important.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is the architecture like in Brighton?
It's obviously a coastal city or town. And it's got a lot of Victorian heritage. Mm-hmm. A lot of the same is where I'm from in Southend. Is one thing that is really lovely about it, that they keep this sort of quirky character of the area. And I think that's sort of, everyone's very proud to be from the area and to study there. That's something that's not necessary. It's hard to ingrain that within an area. And it's a wonderful place.
And afterwards, you went to Greenwich for your part two.
Yes, yes.
How was that?
Yeah, that was likewise an incredible experience. Very different, though, going into a degree level. I think your degree is harder than your master's. When you do a degree trained in anything, you've got still very little life experience. When you're at your master's, you're a mature student. So I moved to London and to Greenwich. There was tutors there that I wanted to be taught by for my master's. And that was a lot of the decision in going there. They were guest tutors when I was in Brighton. And I was always inspired by their narrative-driven architecture and model making, which is something that I was incredibly passionate about as a degree-level student.
That's really impressive that you kind of... they stayed in your mind to the point where they were part of the decision to go to Greenwich. Like, I don't, reflecting on my own university experience, I don't think I was ever that inspired by a lecturer that I was like, I need to go and do a master's at this university to be to learn from them. You know, is that quite unique?
I don't know. I guess I never really thought about it in that way. It was certainly, you know, probably the biggest driver for me because not everyone is driven and inspired by the same types of architecture. Architecture is incredibly broad. And that was when I finished my degree, I was very much into model making.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I spent a lot of my time doing. Mm-hmm. And these were the best at that and telling stories through their designs.
Yeah.
So that's who I want to be my mentors for the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. But Greenwich as well it's the first time that I moved to London. And it's just such a wonderful place to be. The heritage again, the openness of the space. It didn't quite seem like London, but you had the
sort it's of got a sense of calm.
Yes.
That doesn't, you know, you wouldn't think is London, but then, yeah, like you say, it has the heritage of London as well. It's a lovely combination.
Yeah. It's a wonderful experience. And again, I studied with my business partner now. We studied at Greenwich together. That was something, we was in the same unit, so we were almost competing with each other in a very friendly way.
Yeah.
But it became a huge a benefit and an advantage for us to both be quite driven at the time to want to achieve something good and to learn new things. And I delayed doing my master's for 2 years, which is somewhat regular in the industry. Some students will do 1 year. At the moment, the industry is not very good, so there's a lot of students that will follow straight in.
Okay.
And that practical experience in between, where you're working on, you know, some sort of generic sort of residential schemes, allowed me to again really sort of embed myself in practice, but then to take that skill set back into your master's and apply it to, you know, quite grand schemes and ideas.
Yeah. What kind of projects were you working on in your part two?
For the university?
Yeah.
So we did 2 years were very distinctly different. The first year The project is, I'm going back a little while now. The first year was a European centre situated in Lambeth. So it was all about, at the time we were 2016 going through the Brexit vote.
Yeah.
And it was unpacking the general consensus of that and as architecture, what role that would play in that decision.
Did it have a big impact on the flow of architects into the UK? Because, you know, the freedom of movement was restricted in that sense, and there must have been sort of a restriction on the creativity that you then get in London.
Yeah, I don't think we would, I couldn't put my finger down and say that we ever saw much of a change.
Mm.
But you certainly are aware of the bureaucratic challenges to still get into those roles. And yeah. I think it's more your peers as to who you're sort of teaching or learning with.
Mm.
And as academics now, we teach one day a week now at Greenwich University. So we've kind of gone full circle. You certainly see that there is a drop in the international students coming to the UK, which is a shame because, again, architects need to be able to draw on a diverse set of perspectives, cultures, and groups. So
yeah,
it is a shame.
After you graduated from Greenwich, who did you start working for? What was that kind of journey like until you started MIBE Architects?
Yes, so after I finished a part two, what I wanted to do, I wanted to go and work for one of the biggest architects.
Mm.
That was my goal. That's my next aim.
Is that sort of a general goal of architect?
I think
graduates.
So. I think so. Some of it is, in some ways, you're trying to get a name on your CV.
Yeah.
And again, my part one was at a very small residential practice.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted the opposite experience. Mm-hmm. It was also important to me that I had a broad range of experience, and I could be on a part of mega projects or mm-hmm. big iconic projects. So I went to work for a company called Hawkins Brown.
Mm-hmm.
And worked with some of the most incredible architects.
Mm-hmm.
Spent 3.5-4 years helping to deliver Crossrail and Tottenham Court Road specifically,
yes.
And other large infrastructure projects in West Ham, and some residential, multi-unit residential experience.
So tell me about Tottenham Court Road, because I was literally there yesterday, and this is before I saw on your website that you were part of the design of the Crossrail station there. And I messaged a friend and said, oh my God, this is one of the most impressive stations, because as you come out, it's so modern. I can't believe I'd never sort of picked up on that before.
Yeah. So was that the first time you've been down?
I've definitely been to Tottenham Court Road station before, but I think it was that time of the evening. I walked past the Samsung sort of building, and they were doing like a screening of something. But the ceiling is so high in there, and it's this like graphic like film that's on where it looks all like 3D, and it's really impressive. And everyone's standing in there, sort of like filming it. And yeah, it was like nothing I'd ever really stumbled upon before in London.
I believe that's actually the most visited tourist attraction in London.
Is it? Wow.
Don't hold me to that. Tottenham Court Road is an incredible experience. And I don't think any one person could take any credit for the design of it because it went on for so long. It's almost a 25-year project.
Really?
So any role in 3.5 years at Hawkins Brown, my role is really small, and it's part of such a large team of architects, structural engineers, designers, and consultants. But to be part of that is just a wonderful experience. And working with contractors at that scale, so that was delivered by Langer Org Station.
Okay.
And a lot of the conversations, it's interesting because when it opened, when I joined Hawkins Brown, we went down to the stations to sort of see how it was looking. And, it's fairly empty. It almost looks complete like it did on the day it opened, but this was 4 years before.
Okay.
But there was so many compliance things to get through and the level of detail that goes into it. And I think it's a wonderful spectacle.
Yeah.
And it deserved to win its recent awards, which I know at the time there was a lot of pressure on sort of budgets for the overall project going over. And I don't think that's something we now look back at, and what it's done for London and transport across the city is something to really be proud of. And I think it sort of sets the way for infrastructure in the future.
Yeah.
Not just in the country, actually. It's certainly after Crossrail, the delivery of that and the practices, and not just Hawkins Brown that I worked with, but international countries are all looking for that expertise from London practices that delivered these stations.
Yeah.
So a lot of my old colleagues and peers are now in Canada and America and all sorts of large infrastructure projects that are going to be delivered here on. And they use that as a case study to sort of show them the way, but use that expertise as to sort of take those projects forward.
In your opinion, is London sort of a world leader in architecture and urban design?
In infrastructure, I think the answer to that is yes. In other typologies, probably not. Because we don't, European architecture, there's a lot of craft. And here it's sort of, the budgets are really small and they're sort of value engineered down to somewhat basic buildings.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's anything to be proud of what the general building industry looks like at the moment in this country.
Yeah.
But for something like the scale of what went into Crossrail and the coordination of that, the amount of people involved, and just to sort of cut through the heart of London with all those buildings above and the network of existing tunnels, that's certainly leading across the world.
Yeah. Definitely. Could you tell us a little bit about the residential development you worked on for Hackney Wick?
Yes. So, again, still in my time in Hawkins Brown, we were looking at one of the last sites in Hackney Wick that was being developed by the LLTC.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a large, I can't remember the exact number of units now, about 170 odd units that were developed with free practices. So we were working with two of the plots we were running, and two plots were run by smaller practices, Studio Weave and Devil Dead and Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a wonderful scheme for Notting Hill Genesis, so another large developer. And it was a wonderful, that was probably my first experience of working on large residential projects.
Yes.
And it was a huge transition from being in the infrastructure department at Hawkins Brown, different pressures, different clientele, and incredibly large pre-app documents that we would go into planning, revisions of designs. It kind of the meticulous nature of design process and how design is not necessarily a linear process was quite important. Sometimes we're two steps forward, one step back, or vice versa. Actually, the saying is the other way around. So it was great to get my teeth into large residential experience. And again, some of the leading projects in the country. And since actually, we still sort of use that as, or use those experiences as huge case studies. We don't obviously do anywhere near the size of that project in what we do now. But it becomes the sort of the case studies that you use in your own career to sort of test design and how we need to be coordinating with a host of a lot of people. We think, the architect draws, but really and truly the architect talks. They talk to an array of consultants. It's never their design. Actually, we're just the ones that put it together at the end and chair the meetings. It's the easy job, really.
Yeah.
But I think just expanding beyond just a sort of analog task of drawing a building to coordinating a building and what goes into that is really important.
Yeah. I mean, what was the process like for Hackney Wick? Who was the clientele?
Clientele was Notting Hill Genesis.
Yeah.
The process of that would be we would be on quite strict deadlines every 2 weeks or so. And internally there's deadlines on deadlines on deadlines.
Yeah.
So you're kind of always pushing through new reports and presentations. Mm-hmm. That means about, you know, documenting and evidencing our full process. And there's a lot of constraints as a design develops. There's unknowns that become known and through surveys or all sorts. But also then getting planners on board. And I think that was the first time I was introduced to sort of that pre-planning process that can last almost a year. It could be pre-planning on a small scale project would be maybe one meeting with a planner, get their thoughts. Pre-planning on a large project like that, as I say, it could be 8-10 meetings.
Yeah.
Each meeting is 2-3 hours long.
Yeah.
And it's presented with a dossier of information. You know, normally circa 100 pages of design drawings and iterations. And you're trying to gauge, get their approval and get their sort of buy-in to design, the narrative, the design, but also be pushing your client's brief of, you know, maximising the potential of the site whilst, you know, being compliant with regulations, of course, and design guides.
So would you say projects like that are more difficult when you have a lot more people and different parties involved in comparison to the kind of works that you do at the moment where, you know, residential works, is that more relaxed?
It is, but I think one of the things that me and Alex have brought into our small scalar projects is still that meticulous approach to design.
Yeah.
And it kind of, we're really proud of that. And we're really proud of, you know, evidence in the journey of a design, rather than kind of going into planning a little bit blank and hoping that they like it. There's, you know, there's no way that what you think and your passion that you've got for design and the decision-making that's gone into a set of plans can ever just be picked up by someone reading a set of GAs. So we continue that practice today. And I think that's allowed us to get a few projects through, whereas if we wasn't to submit that dossier that's attached with it, you know, it would be rejected because no one's going to appreciate the level of thought that's behind the scheme. You know, for some of our larger sort of residential new build projects, that creates our planning argument. And I think clients are really proud of that. And I think we value that quite highly.
And that documentation must be really important for yourselves as well to kind of reflect on your thought process there. So in the future, you can make decisions a bit kind of quicker, you know, looking back. I know that, like, even just having a diary for personal use, like, it's really helpful to look back at, you know, how you've handled problems and then, you know, take that approach in the future and think, oh, I've already been through this rather than
the more that we do, the more, you know, we create our own case studies that help us in further projects.
Yes.
But, you know, we'll always, every project's new and you can only draw on your own experience.
Yeah.
But you draw on the wider design team. So we still collaborate with large design teams, even in the residential sector.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of projects don't, but we see the value of that for our clients' sake, not just ours. It's, you know, we expand that team and we appreciate that we don't know everything. We're not mechanical or electrical engineers. We're not structural engineers.
Yeah.
And we're not planning consultants. We all have our role and we know a little bit about all of them, but we're certainly not experts. And I think what we do appreciate is that that wider knowledge is where projects harmonize and they become de-risked for our clients.
Yeah. And that sort of honesty must inspire trust from your clients as well. I mean, how important is it for you to have trust in a client, you know, from the get-go?
A lot of what we do is building that trust. Especially majority of our projects being in the residential domestic sector. Clients usually have never built before. It's the largest investment that they're about to undertake.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information They could get a lot of different advice.
Yeah.
And it's important that they can sort of rely on us to give them the guidance. Yeah. You'll certainly have clients that need a little bit more guidance than others.
Yeah.
But to know that we've got their back in a scheme, mm-hmm. and we're constantly looking out for their interests, mm-hmm. be it financial timescales, or just the general management of a project for, you know, dealing with disputes between builders and clients. And I think that's something that we've become really proud of as well. In the last couple of years, we've done a lot more contract administration work, so site support, whereas previously we didn't. And that's really where we see projects come to life, mm-hmm. And we see that our role is far more broadened, and the connection with builders is really important, and making sure that we're around when those decisions are being made. So if a builder, you know, if a client trusts you, that's one thing, but the builder to us is also one of the most important things. Mm. If they don't trust us, they're not going to, if something goes wrong, they're not going to give us a call. Mm. Or if they've got to a point where they're going to make a decision and they don't know quite which way to go.
Yeah.
We want them to give us a call. If we become somewhat difficult, they won't trust us anymore. Mm. And therefore we lose some control of that project. Mm. So also accepting that just because we've drawn it a certain way doesn't mean that's the right way.
Mm. Are you often challenged on your drawings?
I wouldn't say challenged, no. There's obviously a process to get that through the sort of relevant codes. But we're also not, we can take it on board. A builder may prefer to do it a certain way.
Yeah.
And it's all about efficiency and speed, but quality is ultimately the most important thing.
Yeah.
If they're used to a certain process, just because we've drawn it a different way, could slow down that process. And if we don't, we'd like to check that, you know, is that still okay? Do we still meet the regulations?
Yeah.
Is there a financial benefit to that? And sometimes actually the financial benefit you won't see in a cost. It's just the efficiency of the site team and how they are used to building.
Okay.
But I think there's a huge breakdown in the industry between builders and architects. A lot of them, there's somewhat lost respect for each other's worth or input. And I think, being in a larger practice, you value the contractor's knowledge. You know, they do this more often than what we do. And I think that I've taken that from my dad, really, of... Mm. If I draw something and, a long time ago, and it wouldn't make sense to him, you know, he would go, oh, this is not how I want to build it. Yeah. And, you know, the architect can't hold on to it as this is absolutely the only way you can do it. There's 100 ways to build a building.
I guess you come at it from very distinct and separate realms of understanding. I mean, builders, many, you know, will only be college educated in whatever trade they have, and architects will then have done the part one and the part two, so you're kind of tackling the same projects together, but your perspectives are going to be entirely different. I mean, do you often work with the same builders? Does that ever happen, or are your kind of project locations quite
it varies. We go out and we manage a lot of tenders now for projects. So clients will come to us, and we'll have builders that we've worked with before that we trust, and we like to work with them.
Yeah.
They'll know how we like to work.
Yeah.
And again, you know, building that trust is really important. Mm-hmm. Are they going to be a difficult builder to work with is quite important.
Yeah.
Are they going to listen to us? But vice versa, are we going to listen to them? And I think that's the important thing. We don't want there to be a battle there. We want to put our heads together and come up with solutions. Yeah. Building is not straightforward. It's incredibly complex. And there is always something that doesn't quite go to the drawings. The drawings are a guide.
Yeah.
And when you're on site, very rarely does it quite go to plan like that. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to put a practical solution in place to overcome that and not put sort of dig your heels in and sort of refuse to budge. And again, that sort of that way of working was something that we did when we was working on Tottenham Court Road. It was sort of, you know, we would come up with details that we would highlight as, you know, not necessarily compliant. And you had to propose a sensible way of overcoming that. And what I mean by sensible is not just referring the builder back to what was originally drawn, because that's not practical. It's we're past that point. It's what is a solution? Give me a solution that's actually...
It's creativity.
It is. It's using your creative side. And I think that's, you know, it's where architecture thrives, solutions.
Definitely. So tell us a little bit about MIBE Architects. You and Alex started the practice in 2019. How many people do you employ currently?
Yeah, so we've got one part one architectural assistant, and we're actually just interviewing today for part two role as well. Okay. So we're still very small.
Yeah.
We started that, so there'll be four of us come January, working in the office in North Greenwich.
Yeah.
And we've kind of grown that, I was to say grow, it's not grown that much. But we've sort of been building that whilst we were still in our previous practices, as just a sort of, they started as side jobs, you know, one-off private jobs that we would do. We knew that we wanted to set up a practice down the line. One became two became three, and it kind of evolved just naturally through that. And through recommendation, we did a good job. We was very proud of what we did.
Yeah.
And therefore our work kind of showed that we've put hours in. We've crafted these projects, and not necessarily just in the output of the design, but how proud we were to present to a client the level of input that we want them to appreciate. So we would show them that design journey. And I think clients very rarely see the design process behind the screen. And I think bringing them into it makes them part of that design process not just a critique when presented a set of plans. We set that up we started doing projects in 2019. 2021, I believe, we had quite a few projects, and me and Alex agreed that I would leave my previous practice to predominantly run those.
So was Alex still at his?
Yes. So Alex worked on some incredible projects at Arup, so one of the leading engineering firms, but the sports department. So he would do stadiums and...
Amazing.
And all sorts of wonderful,
again,
mega projects. So I left and run a lot of those projects. And about a year later, Alex left his practice as well. And since then, we've sort of continued. We've somewhat now, as projects continue, we somewhat find ourselves in sort of, we've got a niche set of projects, and we're starting to specialize in them, which is, again, sort of Essex-based Greenbelt policy projects. And a lot of those projects require extensive design. They require you to prove to the councils very special circumstances that outweighs the harm to the location. And that comes through considered design work and evidence, and the onus is on us.
Yeah, I mean, tell us about the Briars project.
So that was actually the first project we ever took on back in 2019. So it's probably our longest running project. But there was a lot of processes that we had to put in place to be able to build that planning argument. The site, a beautiful rural area with a tiny little bungalow on it. And the client came to us and said, look, we would, I want to develop this site. I want a quite large, from a tiny bungalow, I want a large five-bedroom modern contemporary house. we said, okay, we'll take a little look, and we put together the plan and argument. Said, look, you're going to have to be patient. This is going to be a long one.
Yeah.
We have to build the argument. We have to build the back case, and we have to build the fallback. So we put several permitted development applications in for the site to look and test what its actual potential is. Those took overly long for the council to come back, but they did eventually. And then we submitted the subsequent planning application. Technically, anything over a percentage larger, or you know, than what was existing there, would fall into a bracket of unacceptable development within the Greenbelt. The proposal that we got through was 540% larger than the original dwelling. But there was tactics again for us to show an evidence that actually what we were designing was subtly embedded into the landscape, yeah. And it blended in with its context. And that meant, you know, doing lovely walks around the site and taking photographs and key views, rendering those views, testing them, doing material studies, and proving to the council that what we've designed is really sympathetic, and it overcomes those quite simplistic volumetric calculations.
Yeah.
So for us, that was probably our biggest achievement to date. And we're in the process now of REBA Stage 4. It's this technical and tender packs that we're developing. We have a host of incredible consultants that have allowed that to sort of get to where it is. And we should see that in the next couple of years come to fruition.
Very exciting.
Which is exciting. But as a case study, a lot of our clients have, or our newer clients, look to that, and it kind of, you know, they want that kind of service on their projects with their sites.
Yeah.
And again, it's sort of we have to be able to know what our value is to that client and what they're looking to get out of it. And that comes with a lot of hours for us to sit down, work it out, make sure that we've got all the constraints in sight so that when it does eventually go to the council, there's not other angles that they could come. You're sort of de-risking. Their job is to de-risk.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of dedication, sounds like. And in terms of sort of sustainability, how does the Briars sort of plans kind of look from that?
Yeah, so we always have to, as part of any project that we do, we have to consider its sustainability. And we've also, Alex is a Passive House certified consultant now. And we apply those principles to the design. That's generally, we want to build only what we need to build. That's rule number one, although that's not in any sort of guidelines. We shouldn't build just for the sake of building. We have to make sure it's right and it's going to work. And the second is that what we do build is good quality, that in 10 years' time, it's not going to become redundant or not last. And I think we have an issue in the country that a lot of new builds are not great, and that they're not, you know, in 10 years' time, someone's going to want to rip them down. So it's just, it could be as sustainable as you want, but if that's coming down and no one wants it, it's not worth. It's not worth it. So we implement that into our build ups and into the design proposal as a general schematic. And then we work with, you know, mechanical and electrical consultants to make sure that the output of energy of the house is understood during that design stage and what we need to be able to power it. And then the general principles of understanding solar gain from the building, how our building wants to passively, you know, alleviate from that stress. So how we clad, how we protect from the hot summer sun and the low winter sun. And then making sure that our thermal and our general buildings are where they need to be. And a lot of that is pushing the minimum standards. So not accepting just because they're the minimum standards doesn't mean that's what we should be building. We should be putting those into our programs and working out, right, what is it and how do we need to develop this building?
Yeah, I guess integrating it into your philosophy.
Absolutely.
As a practice, yeah.
And not thinking about that at the end, thinking about that very much during that planning stage. So a lot of the planning stage went through a lot of coordination with other consultants to ensure that drop ceilings, risers were all in place that could house this equipment. There's a lot of equipment that goes into it. And as soon as we over insulate these buildings and then create this airtightness to it, you know, you need a lot of mechanical equipment to allow them to breathe. Mm-hmm. So we have to make sure that that's allowed for in the design, because if it's not, we are, you know, you're not going to be able to fit those systems, or you're going to have exposed equipment. So it's making sure that that design stage very early on is allowed for it.
Okay, so just to wrap up, Liam, could you give any advice for anyone looking to go into the architecture industry?
Yes, I think it's an interesting time to be doing the architectural education.
Yeah.
The ARB are looking to change or rethink about the route in to practice. Mm-hmm. We've got one model, and that's, you know, your degree, your master's, and then your part three. But more and more approaches are coming out. One is the apprenticeship scheme, mm-hmm. where students sort of work 4 days a week in practice and then spend 1 day a week at university. And I've taught some of those on that course at London South Bank, and it's a really interesting connection. I think a lot of the critique with the current model is there's a real big disconnection between student and academia and professional practice. Mm-hmm. I'd keep an eye out on the new routes that will be sort of are being proposed.
And is that something you wish, if you could go back, you know, you could explore a different route into the industry?
No, I still think I would still pick the route that I took. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important for the industry to have multiple routes in, not just one. And one model doesn't work for everyone.
Of course, yeah, different people.
You know, not everyone can take that amount of time out. Mm-hmm. Not everyone is as academic.
Yeah.
In their approach to design. Yeah. An architect shouldn't be only developed in one model. Mm-hmm. So I think by broadening the routes into the profession, mm-hmm. The profession will benefit from a range of more skilled practical experience mixed in with the academic.
Yeah. I like it, to encourage sort of diversity into the industry. That's a really exciting and fresh perspective that I haven't heard about before. So one for our listeners to definitely check out. Well, thank you so much, Liam, for joining us today on the podcast.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure for us. You've worked on some fantastic projects during your career and at MIBE, and they're definitely the kind of thing that our audience will love to check out on LinkedIn. That's our sort of biggest platform at the moment. And I want to say thank you very much to all of our listeners for tuning in today. Don't forget, you can check out our episodes on Spotify, YouTube, and Amazon Music. And we very much look forward to seeing you all next time on The London Architect. Thank you, Liam.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye.